It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a UW-Madison project that's working to fix local problems around the state is headed to Greene County. The project's director tells us how the university and local residents are working together to find some solutions. First, negotiations on the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, are moving forward between the United States and Canada after talks stalled in previous months. The relationship between the two countries has been contentious since the U.S. imposed tariffs on goods from Canada, and Canada retaliated with tariffs of their own. These talks follow a tentative trade agreement reached between the United States and Mexico. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're seeing these late-night negotiations apparently between our two countries. What's the latest, Adrian?
Well, they basically negotiators were at it all night last night, and they were back at it again today. There's no deal so far, but I understand that they are getting quite close, that it's kind of down to a handful of issues, dispute settlement, access to Canada's dairy market, which is sort of the biggest, at this point, everyone seems to have identified as the largest demand from Donald Trump, and then intellectual property and online shopping and a couple of other things. So I understand, though, that the tone in talk seems to have been fairly constructive, and that both sides sort of feel like the other is sort of willing to play ball. Whether or not that actually leads to a deal in the short term is still to be determined, but the signs seem to actually be fairly positive at this point.
Now, we heard this news about the U.S. and Mexico reaching a lot of agreements just over the last couple of weeks now. Did that put the heat on Canada, this idea that, okay, the U.S. and Mexico could just have a bilateral deal, so long, three-country NAFTA?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the Canadians would sort of deny it, and they'd probably claim that, they sort of understood that the U.S. and Mexico's need to kind of iron out their own issues. But the fact is that Mexico essentially, made an almost complete NAFTA deal with the U.S. and then even kind of adopted the U.S.'s messaging about, how Canada needed to get in, or there's a possibility that they'd move forward bilaterally. And so I think that has put the pressure on Canada. Certainly the U.S. Congress has kind of seemed to suggest that it wouldn't be too pleased to receive only a binational deal between the U.S. and Mexico, but I really don't think Canada wants to test that logic or actually, rely on the Congress to try to check Trump's trade agenda. So I think, yes, I think it has motivated Canada to really try to seek a deal.
President Trump, at least in his rhetoric, seemed to be making the case that we needed a drastic overhaul of NAFTA or get rid of NAFTA, have separate deals with each country, a big change. What are we seeing with the changes we know about? Is this minor tweaks or is this a big change?
Yeah, it certainly won't be the big change that I think Trump has sold it as, but it certainly is a Trumpian, trade deal in terms of certainly when you look at what Mexico agreed to. This is, it takes the trade relationship back, right? Where if you think of trade as trade relations over the last 30 years between the three countries as having been sort of a process of steadily opening the markets more and more and more, this is kind of a step back from that and saying that the market should be a little bit less closed. The main provision there is basically put in a bunch of micromanaging rules on the auto industry where they're trying to sort of dictate, where all the content comes from, and saying that 75% of all the content from autos manufactured in North America has to come from within North America, and out of that about 40 to 45% has to come from factories in where workers are being paid at least U.S. $16 an hour, which essentially puts Mexico at a disadvantage and advantages the U.S. and Canada. So it's a little bit of a turning back on the kind of open market between the three countries. I think that's sort of been Trump's goal. But that said, it's not nearly as drastic as what his opening position was. I mean, a year ago this time, they were talking about trying to impose a 50% U.S. content requirement on all autos made within NAFTA. So it would have forced basically Mexico and Canada to use, 50% U.S. parts in every car that they assembled. And that demands like that have kind of fallen away over time. So it won't be the really big overhaul that I think Trump wanted. But it certainly is a victory for him in the sense that it's going to be a bit more of a protectionist deal than it was before.
Talking to Adrian Morrow from the Globe and Mail, looking at the latest on NAFTA renegotiations. Adrian, it wasn't that long ago, really, in the scope of things that we had these steel and aluminum tariffs coming from the United States, citing security concerns. And this was something that leadership in Canada and the opposition party and the public, it seemed like, was really upset about. Have things cooled off since then?
I'm not sure that they have. I mean, the biggest change I think that we've seen is that when Trump imposed the tariffs, actually even before he imposed the tariffs, he basically said that they were entirely contingent on NAFTA, and so the notion was that once Canada and Mexico agreed to a NAFTA deal with the U.S., he would remove the tariffs. So far, that hasn't happened. Mexico basically made a deal with the U.S. last week and still has the tariffs in place. So I think it actually remains to be seen whether that's still that's still on the table, whether the final deal between all three countries, whenever that's concluded, if it's next week or the end of this month, whether that includes the tariffs being removed, because so far it hasn't. So I think that's sort of one of the big outstanding questions. And I think that if they aren't removed, those tariffs don't go away, I think that people in Canada are going to be disappointed. And I think it's going to be a very difficult thing for the Trudeau government to try to explain, to say we agreed to all this all these other things with the U.S. We kind of gave Trump what he wanted, which was a NAFTA deal that's a bit more protectionist, but we're still facing these tariffs. So I think that's going to be a huge imperative for Canada at the bargaining table. And at this point, it's not really clear if they're going to get there.
Let's talk about dairy now, an important issue for Wisconsin. Some Wisconsin dairy farmers at some points losing their Canadian customers over the last couple of years. From Canada's point of view, you've got this dairy arrangement that helps to keep prices higher for Canadian dairy farmers, which Wisconsin dairy farmers are a little envious of, I think. But those dairy farmers in Wisconsin want the markets in Canada. How is this a solvable problem?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, it's one area where I think Canada is very much willing to give ground on, because they know that this is kind of the big thing that Trump is focused on. And rhetorically, you've listened to him in the last 3 or 4 months. His main complaint about Canada has been all on dairy. So so the Canadian bargaining team is well aware of the fact that they have to do something on dairy to get a deal, and they are willing to do it. What they're probably going to do is they won't actually dismantle supply management, which is basically the protectionist system that jacks up dairy prices in Canada in order to ensure a higher return for Canadian dairy farmers. Instead, I think what they're going to do is first of all, offer U.S. Dairy farmers a percentage of the Canadian market. They did something similar under TPP for Asian countries and under Canada's free trade deal with the European Union for European farmers. They'll basically give some sort of percentage to the U.S. and say, you can export up to this quota within Canada without facing the tariffs. The second thing they'll probably do is change the ultra-filtered milk rule, which was the thing that initially set Trump on this path of sort of going after Canada's dairy industry. It was basically a rule that it's a little bit complicated, but essentially it sort of took away a market in Canada for Wisconsin dairy farmers who are selling this product that's used in cheese making into the Canadian market. So Canada will probably change that rule to make it easier for Wisconsin farmers to sell into the market. And then there's a bunch of other sort of smaller stuff, some rules on ingredients, as well as I think the U.S. has accused Canada of dumping too much dairy product into the international market and pushing prices down. Whether that's actually the case or not, I think is debatable. But I think Canada's probably going to have to address that in some fashion. Within NAFTA to sort of please the U.S. So I think there's a whole bunch of stuff that Canada can do and I think is willing to do. We don't know exactly how far they'll go, but I think, I certainly get the impression that that Canada's going to do a bunch of stuff sort of short of actually dismantling the system.
Is there a risk of a political backlash in Canada if there are concessions made on dairy and supply management? Is it, if you'll forgive me, a sacred cow?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a funny thing in Canada, in the sense that all three parties, all three major political parties in Canada, are sort of wedded to supply management. Far out of proportion to who actually benefits from it. I mean, it's basically the Quebec dairy lobby that has kind of got all three political parties to sort of favor this system. And so I think if they give up too much, they sort of risk losing that constituency. Which is something that the Liberals don't want to do, because because the dairy farmers do have some influence in some ridings. In Quebec in particular. And so I think that there could be some backlash there. That said, though, I think there's sort of a contrary school of thought in Canada, an argument that if you kind of sell this to Canadian consumers by saying, well, hey, this is just opening the market a little bit more, and this is going to lead to more competition, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, there could actually be sort of a victory there for the Trudeau government. But it's a question of whether they're actually able to make that case versus the Quebec dairy lobby, which may be unhappy with whatever changes allow more American product into the market.
So we're pulling all-nighters in these negotiations. What are you watching for in the coming days to see if there's a deal that both sides like, that the American president will still agree with his negotiators on, and this thing gets done?
Yeah, I mean, the dairy thing, of course, is probably the number one at this point to see, you know, if Canada goes far enough to please the U.S., and in particular to kind of really make Trump feel like he's got a victory here, and it's something he can sign off on. The second thing is Chapter 19, which is a dispute settlement provision that essentially Canada has used to overturn American tariffs on softwood lumber and some other products in the past. You know, that's basically the one thing that Canada has always marked as the red line in talks and said, you know, they won't sign a new NAFTA if it doesn't preserve Chapter 19. So I think that's going to be the other big one, that, you know, there'll be a question of, you know, does the U.S. Agree to that, basically agree to leave Chapter 19 in the deal, or, you know, or bargain it down to some other, you know, diluted, you know, form, but at the very least sort of maintain some kind of dispute settlement mechanism that Canada can live with. You know, there are a few other sort of, you know, a few other smaller issues on intellectual property and cultural, you know, exemptions for cultural industries in Canada that I think Canada's looking to see, but looking for in a deal. But at the end of the day, I think it really is, you know, dispute settlement and dairy that's probably going to make or break this thing.
Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for The Globe and Mail. He was with us to give us the latest on ongoing NAFTA negotiations. Towns and cities across Wisconsin are facing a long list of issues. Things like affordable housing and the opioid crisis and others are all felt first on the local level. And that's where the Universe City Alliance, a project with UW-Madison, comes in. It gets students and teachers working to help fix those problems. Just kicked off its third year. Gavin Luter is the project's director. Gavin, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Well, talk about what you're doing. You've got these university resources. You're getting out into communities and doing what?
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's a pretty simple concept. It's interesting. I've worked in the service learning area for a while. It took me a long time to explain to my family what it is that I was doing. But finally, with this project, it made a lot of sense. So what we do, it's called the University, C-I-T-Y.
Did I say it right?
Alliance. You got it. Okay. Exactly right. Just want to make sure if people are looking it up, it's not S-I-T-Y. It's C-I-T-Y. So essentially, local governments are struggling with a lot of issues, a lot of things that, you know, big problems like land use and housing and homelessness, they all kind of are manifest at the local level. So they're struggling with a lot of issues. It just so happens that we have professors and students who are on campus who are struggling with those same exact issues in the classroom. So what we do is we get a local government, we work with them, one local government per year, we get them to list their priority areas, and then we match existing UW courses into those priority areas. So those classes will take on a priority area for their semester-long or year-long project, depending on the class. So we're addressing community issues, and we're also addressing the issue of UW-Madison getting out into the community.
So give us some examples of the kinds of classes and the issues they've been tackling so far.
Yeah, interestingly, one of our best partners is the School of Engineering. We have a local school. We're going to be working with Greene County this year. It's called Judah. There's like one K-12 school inside Judah, and they want to get their renewable energy to 25% of use. So we have three courses. One is going to be looking at energy efficiency practices that the school can do. Another one's going to be looking at the life cycle analysis and the potential costs and benefits of using different renewable technologies like solar, wind, and geothermal. And then the engineering capstone project, so seniors who are graduating engineering students are going to be coming in and actually designing a system to get to that kind of magical 25% mark. Now, that's a little bit more detail, but we've also done things on cost benefit analysis of starting a municipal Wi-Fi service, or we've done park upgrades, or how do we preserve Ho-Chunk culture in our parks through signage and special initiatives.
I want to talk about how you identify the problems. Is this a thing where the university folks come in from the outside and tell the locals what the problem is, or is there some kind of collaboration leading up to these classroom experiences?
Absolutely not. I definitely want to emphasize that it's not the university coming in and saying, here's what we think the issues are. So this is a three-phase, roughly three-year partnership that we have with the local government. And essentially, we work with local leaders to identify what their issues are. Now, you know, almost every, if anybody's listening to this, you know your local government has a strategic or a comprehensive plan, probably. Well, oftentimes they're kind of sitting on the shelf. They wish they could be doing more with these projects, but they oftentimes city government, local government, town, county, they're usually the leanest form of government. And so they don't always have the capacity and the time to do everything that they want to do. So they kind of list off, hey, here are some things that we've identified in the past. Actually, in the best case scenario this year, Greene County has put together our health projects are all coming from the Locally Driven Healthy Communities Coalition. That is a combination of public, nonprofit, and for-profit entities sitting on that group. So that's where we came up with everything from breastfeeding in the workplace to the opioid crisis. And that's going to be through this kind of multi-sector process of setting priorities. So it's not UW coming in. The only constraint that we might have is, well, we don't really have a class that's taught about that, so we can't necessarily address that issue. But let us work to get you some contacts with some people who can help.
Now, Greene County is the third time around here you've done the city of Monona and Dane County, so a little closer to home for UW-Madison. What kind of things have come out of that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So our first year, like you said, was the city of Monona. Interestingly, the only way that we got started is we were kind of, you know, talking with a bunch of people around the country who are doing this, and then we spoke at a meeting, and the mayor of Monona heard about us and said, we want a closer connection with UW-Madison. And so from there, we went on, and they identified the priority area of basically how to better digitally connect with their citizens, parks and recreation, active transportation, and housing and economic development. And so far, what we've seen kind of come out of that is they have like a master plan for parks and walking and biking trails that's completely been updated. And now they're kind of working on some of those priority areas that we kind of co-facilitated, jointly decided with the local partner. We actually just had a request. They want to put up a public art piece. So that's kind of building on our efforts there. So we connected them with a UW-Madison sculpture professor who's now going to be sitting on their planning committee for putting up some of these things. So there are things like that, but finding out better routes to school. There are, the city of Monona actually made some changes to their website based on the feedback that the college students were giving them. Dane County is updating its housing plan, and they actually had a housing summit coming up in October, and they're using some of the site analyses that we did in our classes as a place to kind of start, I guess you could say. So those are some like basic things. I think they are starting to kind of get out of the box a little bit, not to overstate that UW-Madison has, you know, corners the market on all things innovative. But I do think that we come to the table with some interesting ideas. Some might seem pie in the sky, but it gets them to think a little bit differently.
Talking to Gavin Luter, director of the University, with a C, not an S, Alliance, a program connecting UW faculty and students with local communities. The new round is in Greene County. Gavin, what do the students get out of this?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think the number one thing that probably everybody listening to this radio broadcast has thought once in their lives is, why am I taking this class and what am I getting out of it and how does this apply to the real world? Well, the students who actually come and take our classes, they're the ones who are putting things on the CV, their curriculum vitae, their resume. They're going to be actually able to go out and talk about how their learning in the classroom was directly applied to things going on in the real world. So I think students are getting workforce skills. They're getting also civic skills, realizing like a lot of them don't know anything about local government. I admittedly didn't really know too much about local government until I got here, and I just realized how mammoth what local governments have to deal with really is, and yet how lean they are to have to deal with those things. So I think students get a sense of something bigger than themselves, and also new career opportunities. Sometimes our students are interacting directly with private sector consultants. Sometimes they're directly interacting with the department heads in the local government. I think our students are getting a sense of what democracy looks like on the ground and how they can contribute through their specific professional skills to a larger set of problem solving in society.
Now, if somebody with a local government is out there saying, yeah, I want to play, how do they get on the list?
Yeah, they get on the list by simply contacting me. It's really not that hard. Unfortunately, we don't have a ton of people, you know, batting down the doors because local government have to be in the right place to be able to work with us. So we've had, you know, kind of the right amount of people talking with us. We're kind of have irons in the fire and a couple of people. And essentially, how did that happen? They contacted me, Gavin at Cows, COWS.org, or universecity@wisc.edu. Just get in touch with me. And we just start talking about, you know, where is your city? Where is your town? Where is your village? Where is your county? You don't even just have to be one place to be working with you. Say you might think, oh, I don't know if my local government can handle this, but maybe my neighboring county and us, we can work together on it. We are totally open to working with clusters of local governments or anything like that. So really, it's a simple answer. Contact us and we will definitely talk.
Can you talk about how this fits into the university mission? We hear about the Wisconsin idea and, you know, back in the old days, figuring out how dairy farmers farmers can measure butter fat and things like that. Talk about how that fits into that history.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about the Wisconsin idea a lot, and a lot of people don't realize that the Wisconsin idea kind of went back to kind of governance reform, state governance reform in the state of Wisconsin to make our democracy more for, by, and of the people. And so this really is University of Wisconsin collaboratively working with people out in the community. The thing is that local communities have a lot of expertise to offer our students, and we have a lot of expertise to offer to them. So it's really mutually beneficial.
Are other universities, colleges coming to you and saying, hey, Gavin, how can we steal this idea and do it in, you know, in our backyard?
Yeah, it's a really great question. There is a national network of people who are doing this work. If you go to epicn.org, you can see other colleges, universities who have actually taken this up and done it for themselves. But yeah, there are a lot of other UW system institutions who have contacted me about an interest, even private. I'm meeting with the mayor of Kenosha in a few weeks, and I'm meeting with them jointly because of a partnership that we have with Carthage College, small private liberal arts school in Kenosha. So absolutely, we're open. If you're from a UW institution or another college or university in the state, contact me, and you might want to get your local government involved. So yeah, we're totally open to that.
Now, classes just started this week at UW-Madison. Do you get to go and visit the different classes, engineering, sociology, what have you, and see how they're getting rolling on this?
Yeah, we do get a chance to go visit the classes. And for this year, for the first time, we've started a one-credit course that all students who are participating in this initiative, we'll go through a series of videos to prepare them to make sure that they're ready to work with the community. So I don't have to physically visit all the classes anymore. Thank goodness. We have about 25 classes on average that work with us per year. But yeah, we do prepare the students, and I do get a chance to see. I mean, when you talk with the students who have done this stuff, I mean, that's the selling point right there. If you're a faculty and you ever wonder, oh, should I get involved with this? Talk to a student who's been involved, and they are the best people who can sell the initiative.
And briefly, lots of field trips involved to Green County?
Yeah, quite a few field trips. In fact, they've asked us to come to Cheese Days on the 14th of September, and they're really excited about us coming there. So it's an interesting initiative. And I also, just for the people who are listening, if you're kind of wondering, like, you know, where does the money come from? This is not a typical UW program. We do have funding support from American Family Insurance, and actually alumni, John Holton, through the Hometown Partnership Program. Local governments actually pay a fee to be involved with this, so they have some skin in the game. And it's the Baldwin Idea Endowment, all this kind of private, public sector funding we're flowing into this. So just so your listeners know that.
All right, Gavin, thanks a lot for coming up.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Gavin Luter, director of a project out of UW-Madison called the UniverCity Alliance. It pairs teachers and students with communities around the state to help them solve local problems. It just kicked off its third year working in Greene County. The Men's Shed began in a small farming town in Australia nearly 20 years ago as a way to bring older men together without stigma. Since its founding, chapters have sprung up across the globe, and there's a move to start one now in southwestern Wisconsin. Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson talked to John Meidinger, manager for the Platteville Senior Center, about why they want to start a men's shed in their community.
John, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, JC. Thanks for having me.
So tell us just a little bit about the goals of the Men's Shed.
Well, you know, men, older men in particular, seem to suffer disproportionately from the ill effects of social isolation. And the Men's Shed, which started in Australia, I believe, 20, 25 years ago, has proven to be a very effective sort of socio-medical intervention and helping to alleviate some of those issues.
And the Men's Shed, as you just mentioned, started in Australia. It's jumped the pond since then. There are a few in Canada, I believe, and you're trying to start one in Platteville. So how did you first hear about the Men's Shed project?
Well, here at the Senior Center and PEAK program, we're always looking for effective ways to keep older adults socially active. And it was just in Googling, I came across, I believe it was changex.org, which is a nonprofit out of Ireland that looks for precisely these types of well-proven concepts. And I started reading about the Men's Shed and was just immediately taken with it. I think it is a really genius idea.
And what about it appeals to you and will also appeal to the people that you work with?
Well, there's a few different things that I think are really wonderful about the concept. First of all, it's very much bottom-up. You know, it requires a lot of participation from the people who will be benefiting from it. And oftentimes, social efforts are more top-down and have a lot of restrictions and kind of prohibitions. But, you know, the Minshed concept is just wonderfully variable, and it's really customizable to the needs of the participants themselves. And, you know, at its root, it is a health by stealth effort, which I think is very important. Sometimes in our talks, we speak a lot about the fun side of it, sort of the clubhousey atmosphere and the big tools and things like that. But the health benefits are first and foremost on our mind here in Platteville.
Can you go a little bit in depth on that, the health by stealth that you just mentioned, and why the Minshed might be a really good place to get men to talk about, you know, health issues that they might not otherwise?
So it's probably no secret that men are not always the greatest communicators. You know, sort of a great insight put forth by someone involved with the Minshed at some point was that men tend not to talk face-to-face. We talk shoulder-to-shoulder. We sort of need some other activity through which to really communicate and bond with one another. You can imagine a couple guys sitting at a bar, watching a game, or leaning over a car engine, working together. We just, unfortunately, are not great communicators, certainly nowhere near as good as women when it comes to maintaining friendships and staying socially active. And so the Minshed just really entices guys to come out, be around other men in particular, although there are co-ed sheds and community sheds. And it helps people just talk about what's going on with themselves. It seems to help with depression, seems to help with alcoholism. You know, unfortunately, older men suffer from higher rates of suicide as well. And so finding this renewed meaning, finding these new friendships, doing things for the community, which is what a lot of Minsheds tend to do, is just so important. And I think it's just a wonderful program that I hope spreads throughout the state.
You work with senior citizens. What have they said about the need for something like a Minshed in your community?
The response has been really great. We're very much in the formative phases at this point. I've been getting the word out, but people seem to be really taken with it when they come across it. A lot of our folks here in Wisconsin, of course, will winter down south, and some of the places they go have something similar to a Minshed in them. So they have experience with this concept and are looking forward to bringing it to, you know, our small rural town here. It's just, I think, a matter of finding. We need to find a few key people to really run with the program. That seems to be a absolute necessity for Minsheds. They're finding, you know, those first few real evangelists who go out into the community and hopefully find a space.
So when are you hoping to sort of get this started and going in Platteville?
Well, in a more sort of informal way, we've had some guys who have been helping us out here at the Senior Center for quite some time. We've moved into a former elementary school last year, and they're sort of our in-house handyman group. They've done some great projects here on the campus of the Senior Center, and we are in the process of forming a steering committee. And hopefully from there, the next step will be just, you know, spreading the word. And at some point, I think it's important that this group in particular finds a place. Sometimes Minsheds work well as just a program that don't necessarily have, you know, that shed space. But I'm hoping that here in Platteville we can find a building of some sort so they can really get that sense of ownership that comes with the Minshed.
John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about this today.
It is my pleasure. We appreciate your interest.
That was John Meidinger, manager of the Platteville Senior Center. He talked to Central Time producer Jay Carlisle Larson about his organization's efforts to start what's called a men's shed in Platteville as a way to tackle social isolation, especially for older men. Now we continue the conversation about loneliness among older men with Dawn Carr. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Florida State University. Dawn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk about this problem we seem to have with social isolation for older men. How bad is it? What's the impact?
Well, as mentioned by and unfortunately, I don't remember his name.
John, yep.
John, I'm sorry. As mentioned by John, yes, the issue of loneliness is one that has gained a lot of attention more recently because there's growing evidence that loneliness and social isolation are quite detrimental to health. It's something that's affecting people at all ages, but older people in particular are more at risk of becoming lonely and socially isolated for a variety of reasons. And men seem to be more likely to have negative effects from these things. There are lots of reasons why we think that might be the case, although we don't know for certain. One factor does seem to be, as John mentioned, sort of the tendencies that men haven't, at least in this cohort, haven't developed many of the kind of deep relationships outside of their marriage a lot of times. So when they become widowed, they're especially at risk because they've spent a lot of their adult life becoming engaged socially with their spouse and not in separate relationships. So in later life, when they're likely to face widowhood, they're often having to then rely on other people for their social interactions, and that's difficult to establish. So having the opportunity to build social connections with others is extremely beneficial. Sure. And helps combat those problems.
Hearing about an effort like the Men's Shed, in this case, it sounds like they get them together and they lure them in. They get to work together on projects. It's not just a hangout. What do you think of that kind of idea as a community health intervention, basically?
Yes, there's actually quite a lot of evidence that things like that work particularly well. So although this is really, I would call, a volunteering sort of effort, there's this effort for social good, connecting with others around something that you care about. This is a great way to build relationships. You know, we have shared interests. We don't have to talk about our feelings. We can talk about the thing that we are both committed to and engaged with, or this group of people. And volunteering, there's lots of evidence, is extremely beneficial, not just for combating loneliness, which there's plenty of evidence of that, but also it's beneficial for increasing depression and increasing sort of physical health as well. So improvements in physical health in some cases. So people stay healthier longer. And there's a lot of support for volunteering efforts more recently because it's got this really cool outcome where you're not just benefiting the person doing it, you're also benefiting the community. So it seems like it's better than like going to the gym, you know, and just working out and going home, which is beneficial for health. But sometimes people meet others there. But having something of shared interest and purpose and gives you a sense of what you're doing matters for others is extremely helpful.
And it seems like we hear more and more that having a sense of purpose, having social connections, these are important not only for mental health, though that's probably important enough on its own. These have an impact on physical health, too.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you talk about the connection?
One of the most profound. Absolutely. So one of the most profound findings several years ago, there was a meta-analysis that got a lot of attention nationally because and what I mean by meta-analysis, they looked at a whole bunch of studies that have been done on loneliness. And what they found was that that loneliness was as bad for your health as smoking. So a lot of people have talked about the consequences of loneliness being similar to smoking. And this was largely related to mortality. So all things being equal, people who are lonely die faster than people who aren't. Interestingly, volunteering has also been connected to decreased mortality rates. So people who volunteer and engage in these kinds of meaningful activities are much more likely to experience physical health benefits. And we don't actually know why these things are occurring, but if it's because they're less lonely or because their mental health improves, there's a lot of reason we have sort of a physiological response to doing these kinds of activities. So we decrease stress levels in the system and decreased inflammation in the system that could, you know, sort of translate to these physical health benefits.
We're talking to Dawn Carr right now. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Florida State University. She focuses on mental and physical well-being for older adults. She's with us to talk about loneliness among older people, especially older men, and what we can do to help them but not be isolated. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you an older person, older man in particular? Have you seen maybe those friendships go away, not maintained? How have you reached out, gotten involved in your community, maybe built those friendships back up if you've been able to? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. And have you taken to doing something like volunteering or some kind of social activity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation about loneliness among older men and ways to ease that isolation. Dawn Carr is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Florida State University, where she focuses on the mental and physical well-being of older adults. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this problem in your own life, maybe that of a family member? Or have you seen ways to get past it as a senior yourself? Have you gotten out and volunteered, made connections, rekindled maybe old friendships? What are you seeing if you're a little younger from your parents' generation? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to a caller now. Karen is with us in Weyerhaeuser. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm looking at, not for myself, but for others. If a person, a man, is widowed, living by themselves, or in assisted care even, and has to live in a different setting, maybe away from all of the familiar attributes of his home, his community, his neighborhood, and has a disability, how and what resources are available to help that person maybe utilize some of their knowledge and be able to share and feel like they're contributing, have a purpose? I'm interested in knowing that.
Karen, thanks for the call. So, Dawn, there's a lot there, but somebody, as she's saying, maybe in a new place, a different home, maybe dealing with now new physical limitations as people are aging, what kind of things are out there for them?
Yeah, I think that's actually a big challenge because the people who are capable of taking on many of these opportunities that we're talking about are the ones who can physically do things. And there's a point at which, as we get older, we can't get out and physically do things. I think there's been some efforts to try to develop opportunities for helping others that don't require some physical abilities, but I don't know whether the benefits are as great when you aren't physically interacting with other people. There is quite a bit of research that talks about the benefits of sort of social engagement with younger people, for example, intergenerational engagement. And I think there have been a few efforts, although I think definitely not enough, to try to figure out ways for people who are socially isolated to have meaningful engagements and relationships with others that allow them to feel like they matter for others. And I think programs like that are frankly they haven't been developed in ways that work well. And I think particularly in long-term care facilities, like Carol was sort of mentioning. And this is a great opportunity for another model that could be delivered. There are some communities around the country that have developed programs where high school students, for example, go and interview older people in different environments and learn about their life history and work together to develop a life history story and help that older person feel like their story is impacting a young person's life by teaching them all these important things about history and their life experiences and so forth. But I think this is a place that there's certainly a lot of room for innovation, and I think it's greatly needed.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Mark with us in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I would like to address transportation in the North Woods for elderly people. I myself had a heart attack. I now have cataracts, can't drive, and now it's I'm isolated. I'm glad I made my own prison, and I'm living here.
Mark, thanks a lot. I'm sorry to hear that. Thanks for sharing that story. Mark, not alone. Dawn, a lot of communities, if you can't drive, it really limits what you can do.
Absolutely. One of the major reasons people are socially isolated is because they can't get around. And men in particular are more likely to have struggles with this because a lot of the engagements that they have are not related to necessarily the people who live in the walking distance area. And particularly if you live in a rural area and the houses are far apart, you're less likely to have a reason to walk to your neighbor's house and visit, for example, and maintain relationships with others that way. So transportation programs are extremely important. And when we're talking about, you know, sort of senior centers and some of these programs, some have developed transportation programs that help people who are kind of in a position where they can't get to a physical location to social events and activities and presentations that are in those senior centers or in those communities, and prioritizing getting access by asking for help if you have someone who can drive you there is worthwhile.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Dawn, I wonder, there's a long-term change going on. The sociologist Robert Putnam has talked about a decline in people participating in organizations. So maybe where that senior might have devoted more time to Rotary or Kiwanis or whatever fraternal organization, those aren't so much there anymore. Is that part of the story of this this disconnect and isolation?
I think it's possible. The people who used to engage in those kinds of activities were, you know, this was things like the Elks Club and the Masons. There are a lot of groups like this for which a lot of older men have participated in the PACs, the Lions Club, where a lot of volunteering and sort of civic engagement were available. But definitely the ways that we socially interact with others has changed dramatically, and young people and older people do have differences as well in how they connect with one another. And not having a regular meeting or a regular event, sort of a structured, institutionalized sort of activity that people connect with others around, makes it more difficult to develop and maintain these relationships.
As we start to wrap up, Dawn, are you seeing bright spots? Are you seeing signs of people doing cool things that are making progress when it comes to loneliness?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of room to see where technology can kind of help combat loneliness. I think you hear a lot about the negative effects of sort of social media, and certainly there are plenty of those. But access to family members through things like Skype and ways to be able to talk to one another and connect online, I think there's a lot of room for people to be able to maintain these relationships in ways that they just never could in the past. We can be physically far apart, but still, you know, emotionally connected. I think also there's growing attention around these benefits of things like the men's shed that we heard about earlier that could help people develop these relationships and really take it seriously. You know, social health is often overlooked as an important part of leading a healthy life. But I think it's increasingly, you know, something people take seriously and acknowledge as a part of living a long, healthy life, a life of meaning and purpose, and in which we maintain meaningful social connections. These are things that matter as much as or more than eating healthy and maintaining physical activity in our lives.
That's a good place to leave it. Dawn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dawn Carr is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Florida State University, where she focuses on the mental and physical well-being of older adults. She joins us today to talk about loneliness among older men and initiatives like the Men's Shed coming in Platteville that we heard about a little while ago, efforts that aim to ease that isolation. Let us know what you've got going on in your community. Email ideas@wpr.org. On my way to work today, I saw the opening preparations for this weekend's big Ironman Wisconsin race. That's one of these triathlon races where, you know, just a marathon, it isn't enough. They run a full marathon and they bike like over 100 miles and swim a couple miles on top of that. That's outside. Inside, there's been a table full of cookies like 10 feet from my office door all day. Farewell cookies for a WPR staffer who's moving on. Plus, somebody put out treats yesterday, and our Central Time producers have a constant supply of chocolate pretzels, which is kind of my fault. I started it. But that's another story. I brought back some cookies from vacation. I'm not going to be running in the Ironman triathlon, but I may have completed some sort of cookie-related triathlon in the past few days. And when we have lots of cookies around, we always refer back to one of our favorite Arnold Schwarzenegger quotes.
Put that cookie down! Now!
And that's something we don't do. We keep picking up and eating the cookies. It's a little worrisome. This is the beginning of September. This is not peak holiday treat season. So things are going to get worse before they get better. I should run an actual triathlon to work off some of those cookies. But I won't. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. Oh, cookie, cookie, cookie starts with C. Oh, C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. Oh, cookie, cookie, cookie.